The trade winds are blowing, the Mai Tais are poured. I'm suffering from a bit of a sunburn, and this is A Gardener's Notebook from the lovely island of Oahu in Hawaii. Obviously, we are traveling, so the sound quality of this episode is a little lower than normal, but I wanted to put together a quick show, say hi to everyone, and also publish our third and final part of our interview with Carrie Dearborn on bird feeding and all things bird watching. I was being very serious about the trade winds blowing. We're staying up here in the Manoa Valley, which is northeast of downtown Honolulu proper, somewhat due north of Waikiki Beach. In the house here, in the background, you might hear wind chimes and the blowing of the wind through the house. It makes for a very enjoyable place to stay. It's always 5 to 10 degrees cooler up here. And most days when we return home, it's actually either lightly misting or sometimes outright pouring down rain. As you might imagine, this leads to a very tropical environment. In fact, we're only about a mile or so from the Manoa Falls Trail, which leads up into the hills to a wonderful waterfall, as well as the botanical garden which exists at the bottom of the fall trail. We found out where the trailhead is, and we plan to get up there and actually investigate the falls a little later in our travels. Things about traveling anywhere, of course, is being exposed to new things. One of the first things I noticed here, of course, were the tropical plants, which we might see occasionally in Southern California, but really don't grow that well there. It's simply too dry. Here we have banana trees leaning over the back fence. We regularly see mangoes and papayas and guavas hanging from the trees here. And, of course, the ubiquitous pineapple. I don't think the pineapple was indigenous to Hawaii, but in the test garden of the Dole Plantation, I found several varieties from several other places in Polynesia and other islands where they did have versions of it, so I assume it was brought here eventually. I'm sure I'll have more to say about our trip here to the island once I get back to the mainland, but for now, let's continue on with the third and final part of our interview with Carrie Dearborn on bird watching and bird feeding. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any questions for Carrie, please send them to agn@welchright.com. And I'll be sure to pass those along to her.
Now, often when we're at public parks, we're at public lakes, especially here in California where water is not as prevalent as it might be elsewhere, we often see signs, and I think always see signs say, please do not feed the birds. Mm-hmm. And the question I had is, how is feeding birds in our own backyard different from the problems that are caused by feeding birds in a public space like a lake or a city park?
Well, frequently, a couple different issues here. Frequently, the birds that are eating in a public space, a public park, are going to be feral birds. Feral birds are birds that of a species that have been domestic or have gone wild, non-native birds. So that's going to be your rock doves here, what people typically call a park pigeon. Here in California and in other places, there are some waterfowl that are causing problems because, like mallards here in California and on the East Coast, Canada geese, because they seem to do very well around people. And people providing food that is not a native food either. Most of the people who go into the park are not going to give the birds that are there their native food. They're going to feed them bread, which is not necessarily a good thing to feed any bird. And also pigeon food, that large food that pigeons will eat, but most of our native birds won't eat. So it ends up causing debris, attracting rats, and other unwanted rodents, and helping to increase the populations of birds that are already somewhat out of control, pushing out the native birds, or even if they're a native bird, getting an imbalance in the number of those specific species of birds.
Well, it also sort of leads us into the question of dependency. Obviously, any situation in which a particular form of wildlife becomes dependent on the human population, you're going to have issues. And I wondered how much of a risk is that in your normal backyard feeder? Mm-hmm. And is there a way to combat that?
Yeah, that's a question that a lot of people are afraid, oh, I'm going to feed these birds, and if should I go on vacation, they won't know how to find their own food. What I see in my own yard is that I get a lot of migratory birds, for one, some of whom are only in my yard for a week or two, even a few days at a time, but they see my yard as an oasis in an suburban, urban sea where there used to be places to stop and get food and get rest. Oh, that's one of my Buick Wrens.
I was looking out the window. We're kind of sitting in Carrie's living room, and we're looking out through the French doors, and I see a bird that I have not seen in my garden yet, but I've just recently started feeding, and I immediately identified it as a wren. It's got the little flicking tail and the longer beak, and I wanted to stop for a moment and point that out to Carrie. It was over her shoulder there, so pardon us there while we interrupt for a second.
Well, that's a perfect example. Wrens are a native bird that have a problem living in close proximity with people. They're fairly shy. I have been trying for years to get them to nest in my yard, and this year I finally have. They're nesting in a nest box that I put out, but it's taken them 3 years and 3 years of me moving it around until it's been in the right place and everything's been just right. But I think the kicker was that this year I started to put out a kind of suet that was specifically for insect-eating birds, and that's what these wrens are. They're an insect-eating bird. I've always seen them in my yard eating insects, but there's never been a guaranteed food source so that they would nest just outside of the yard or somewhere around. This year, they nested here because they know there's food, they know it's safe, and there's water. So I have all of those things that they would look for in a natural environment, a natural habitat. And I think that that is, you know, the biggest thing is we have taken up so much habitat that used to belong to birds. And a lot of species like this little wren, like the titmouse, a lot of woodpeckers, birds that are dependent upon dead trees to find a place to live. We don't like dead trees. We remove them. Those kinds of, a lot of birds are not finding what they need in what used to be their home. And so if we can help to return some of that, it just helps to create more of a balance to take things back to the way they should be. And a lot of these birds are eating the insects that are in my yard. I don't spray anything. I have a completely organic yard. And now I'm also seeing a return of the native reptiles who live here. So it's all interconnected, and helping the birds and making the decision not to own a cat that went outdoors has helped me to try to bring a balance back. So now I've also got rabbits that appear out there. Everything from hawks to wrens nesting in my yard.
So it just proves that even in a small, relatively small area, I don't know, how big is your lot here? Is it?
We're about a half acre.
About a half acre. Here's a half acre lot. Now, granted, you are up on a kind of a hillside.
Right?
You're not in the Santa Monica Mountains by any regard, but you do have a nice wooded area behind you. But it does show the effect you can have on your own little piece of the planet, and if enough people got together and started working together in their own little properties, we could actually have quite a return of wildlife in these urban areas.
Oh, I really think so. I know that just by planting a few native wild plants again out there, I'm also seeing butterflies in my yard that we didn't used to see. So it's amazing how much a difference just even a small area can be. But, I have a hermit thrush who I know must be migrating up into Canada every year. He's been coming here now for 7 years, so I'm pretty sure it's the same bird. I don't know positively, but how he finds this little oasis every year when he comes back is amazing to me. It's amazing that they can do that, but there must be something here. And the grosbeak that make their way through here for a couple days every year, we must be a nice little cafe or a nice little resort to stay at as they migrate through.
Well, it shows the importance, too, of doing it over time.
Right.
And, each year it's going to get a little bit better and a little bit better. The birds are going to start remembering, okay, yes, there is this little spot here that I know I can always stop at that's going to be there for me. And we don't give animals quite the credit sometime for their intelligence that they do have, or their instinctual drive or whatever.
Right,
but
that's definitely true.
They do remember these places and can find their way back to them, so that's very important. We kind of got off the subject of dependence. We kind of started on them when we got distracted by our little visitor there. So obviously you said most of your birds coming through are migratory. They're not here for a long time anywhere. It's not like you're providing the sole source of sustenance for these birds.
Well, yeah, that's true. I do have my regulars, though. I know that I have a pair of California towhees that have raised several... they've been here for a number of years, and I've seen them raise several families through here. And I have probably... My mourning dove population fluctuates between, I would say 4 pair and 8 pair. And I get a lot of house finches. And it is true that those birds, I don't think, go too far. They probably stay fairly close to here. But I was noticing last night when I was outside, because I also have hummingbirds like we were talking about, that right at twilight, I watched a hummingbird come from at least a block away. I saw it coming, went over the house. So I know it went into the back where the feeder is. And then it came out after a few minutes. It came out around the side of the house where the other feeder is and headed back that way. So I'm not sure how large its territory is, because here in Southern California, we have hummingbirds who are residents year-round, as well as migratory birds that go through. But this bird obviously did not live in my backyard. It obviously was coming from a distance to get that topping off before it went to bed. And I have watched my female hummingbirds here with their babies, and the first 2 days that they're out of the nest and flying, they don't come to the feeder. They take them out and around the neighborhood, around the yard, teaching them where the natural food is. And then they come to the feeder on that third day, and it's kind of like, if you can't find the good stuff, this is a place you can always, it's kind of the fast food. It's always a place that you can find food if you need it. And I really do think that that's what most of the birds see the food that I put out there as. I see a lot more activity right before a storm, everybody feeding up before the rain, because it's easier to eat here than it is to go out looking for stuff in the rain. So in the big picture, what I give them is not gourmet. It's not the food they prefer. They would prefer the wild food. I think they go out and they look for that, but there's not as much of it around. And especially, I don't know about people in other parts of the country, but I know here in California we're seeing weather changes causing a problem with how our vegetation, our native vegetation, is growing. So this year, because last fall we didn't get the rain we were supposed to get, our native sycamores did not seed. And so when the goldfinches showed up here, that food that they were dependent upon, the food that they expected to be here, was not here. So if it hadn't been for people who were putting out feeders, there would have been a lot of birds who would have not have found the food that they needed to find.
And they were just passing through. They were perhaps migrating somewhere else, so this just gave them the energy to get down.
Right. We get a lot of them during the winter, the goldfinches, and so we had record numbers at our feeders this year during the winter. And this year, we're for some reason seeing a large number of black-headed grosbeak, which we usually see a couple, but everybody I know who feeds is seeing them. If not one or two, I know people are seeing 5 or 6. I've had 6. This is the first year I've ever had that many. I'm not sure if they're not finding the food that they expected to find somewhere else, if their migratory pathway has shifted slightly, but we're seeing birds this year that we don't usually see, or birds that we see in small numbers, in higher numbers, and there are things that are changing out there in little ways that are affecting the wildlife in bigger ways than I think we are really aware of.
Now, recently you started your own blog. And if I'm lucky, I'll get Carrie podcasting on her own too before too long, and you'll have something else to listen to as well, more about the wildlife and the birds and such. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what it's all about?
I think that I just was looking for a way to put those kinds of things, the observations that I'm seeing in my own yard as far as changes in the plant food not being there for animals, and my own relationship with the animals in my yard and in traveling and what I'm seeing. Just came back from a trip to Turkey, which was beautiful, and I saw a lot of birds that I had never seen before. But we were traveling across country, and in about the fourth or fifth day, I realized that we hadn't seen any wild mammals. And if you've ever traveled across the United States, you know that you see a rabbit, you see a squirrel, a possum, a fox,
an armadillo,
an armadillo, run across the road. Think about not seeing any wild mammals for 10 days, traveling 1,000 miles across the country. It was quite startling. And I think that I was looking for a place to put my own observations out there to see if other people were seeing similar things. Because just like working with Project Feeder Watch and this citizen science project there, I think that there are a lot of individual eyes noticing changes in our world that don't have a voice. And so that's what I was just kind of doing, was looking for a place to voice that.
And what's the address for that?
It is www.animalbites, that's AnimalBytes .blogspot.com.
Yeah, and just for the listeners, I think you can probably get away with just doing animalbites.blogspot.com. I think
you
can drop the www. I think. Try it both ways if it doesn't work. I'll try it when I get home. And of course, there'll be a link to that website and that blog in the show notes as we go through. Well, thank you very much, Carrie, for joining us. It's been a lot of great information.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a lot of fun. We're going to have to go out looking at birds again soon.
You betcha. You betcha. And I'll get it all on tape for you guys. So thanks again, Carrie, and back to the show.
This has been A Gardener's Notebook from the island of Oahu in the state of Hawaii. I'm Douglas E. Welch. If you enjoy A Gardener's Notebook, please consider a vote on Podcast Alley at podcastalley.com or a review in the iTunes podcast directory. The music for today's podcast is The Honolulu Shuffle by Kei Muko, courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. You can also find a link on the website. We'd love to hear what's going on in your garden. Send us email at agn@welchwright.com. Again, that's agn@welchwrite.com, or post your comments on the website. Until next time, keep pulling, keep digging, and be well.